This is the takeaway for Tuesday, February 28th, 2017.
We have to start winning wars again.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Let's win one, says President Trump.
Now, we never win a war. We never win. And we don't fight to win. We don't fight to win. So we either got to win or don't fight it at all.
So after fighting two wars and not winning, President Trump wants to be ready for anything.
This budget will be a public safety and national security budget, very much based on those two, with plenty of other things, but very strong. And it will include a historic increase in defense spending to rebuild the depleted military of the United States of America at a time we most need it.
$54 billion, a 9% increase, he announced this week, to be paid for from cuts in the EPA and the State Department.
Where's the money come from?
Well, the
because it doesn't seem, if you cut all the money from EPA and all the money from state, that's about $50 billion.
Well, I think the money's going to come from a revved up economy.
The president on Fox and Friends, $54 billion is a huge increase in military spending. Are we responding to a threat or watching our capabilities slowly rust away? Dakota Wood is a retired U.S. Marine Corps lieutenant colonel with 20 years of conflict experience. Wood says we're basically running on fumes from the fatigue of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
What happens is the spending has to increase in order to account for the munitions that are used, the fuel that's used in ships and vehicles and in airplanes, all the equipment that was blown up by roadside bombs, those kinds of things. All that equipment has to be either repaired or replaced. So the increase in spending that occurred as a result of Afghanistan and Iraq was immediately consumed in those ongoing operations.
But do you have to replace everything? Everything has to be replaced?
Well, you need to maintain a sufficient amount of combat power to secure your interests. So if you have NATO obligations, and certainly there's concerns about Russia's invasion of Ukraine, Russia's invasion of Georgia, increased naval activity in the Baltic Sea higher than at any time since the end of the Cold War, you have to have a presence there. You also need to have a presence in the Western Pacific. North Korea is an emerging nuclear power. China, much more expansionist, building islands, laying claim to international waters. We've seen what's gone on in the Persian Gulf with Iran and its expansion into the broader Middle East in support of terrorism that has invaded not only Europe, but even onto the shores of the United States.
All right, Colonel, but it sounds to me like you're envisioning a 21st century which involves a possible war with Russia, a possible sea war with China, a nuclear confrontation with Iran and or North Korea. And the president, has said we don't win wars anymore, and so he presumably wants to win. He wants to win one of these conflicts. So, is that the future that we're looking at here?
What you do is you have to plan against potential contingencies and maintain a strong enough posture that those don't occur. So you're trying to prevent a war from happening. But if you show weakness and you don't have the ability to respond to an aggressive competitor, then they will fill in that space. You'll see more Russian activity across Europe, larger conflicts spurred by Iranian-backed terrorism and even stuff coming out of Saudi Arabia, and certainly a greater expansion is China. So, it's not a zero-sum game.
Because
we're quiet.
I totally hear what you're saying.
So by a strong front, you keep those wars from happening. But, now, the president's criticism about not winning is a different matter.
Well, but he's the commander-in-chief. He's the one who's asking for this $54 billion. I mean, he wants to win wars. I mean, as someone who used to be in the military, you hear the president saying, I want to win wars. I mean, is that going to commit?
He is expressing a frustration that all Americans should have, that in spite of the military activity and the investment of American lives in these conflicts over the last 15 years, we haven't had satisfactory outcomes. Things haven't gotten better. And the criticism, I think, is rightly placed that the minimum effort to do anything was undertaken by the Obama administration. It wasn't sufficiently enough to actually solve these problems or to resolve them in a way that was satisfactory to American interests.
When you say that the only way to be ready in a war situation, as you envision, is to build up beyond anyone else's military capability. It sort of explains why, you know, the book 1984 is selling out everywhere. You know, war is peace. You know what I mean?
I think we're being quite unfair in those kinds of things, that you make war in order to have peace. That's not what anybody's saying. It's not what Ronald Reagan said. It's not what Eisenhower said. It's not what John F. Kennedy said. They said that you have a strong enough and competent enough military that it deters your opponent from taking action. If you have a weak capability, that it invites aggression. So the peace through strength is not intended to make war in order to have peace. It's to be ready for war so that your opponent doesn't take advantage of your weakened status.
Is that a stimulus package on some level? I mean, if just forget all the arguments over strategy and policy. Maybe the chief benefit of this is that it's a huge stimulus package.
Right. So you'd be cranking out a lot of Humvees or tanks or making new airplanes, and it will benefit one portion of the economy. But as a percentage of the U.S. economy, it's a very, very small thing. I mean, we're talking a stimulus of, let's say, $54 billion that the president has recommended. That's on an $18 or $19 trillion economy. I mean, health care alone accounts for something like 17 or 20% of the U.S. economy. So when you look at all the other things that go on, as a matter of fact, the infrastructure modernization package that they're being debated at $1 trillion, you know, to fix decaying roads and bridges and tunnels and all the other things across the United States that benefits the economy writ large, that's a much more extensive package. $1 trillion versus $54 billion. I mean, you can't hardly even make that kind of comparison.
Lieutenant Colonel Wood served in the U.S. Marine Corps for 20 years. He's now a senior research fellow for defense programs at the Heritage Foundation. Thank you so much.
Really my pleasure. Thank you.
You can play this game at home. Where would you find $54 billion in the budget? You can't touch the military, though. Chicago, Illinois, I can't touch the military. That's the only thing that I would reasonably cut from.
This is Melissa Willis from Wilsonville, Virginia. If I were in charge of the federal budget and had to make cuts, I would start with congressional salaries, perks, and pensions to bring them in line with the people they serve.
John, and I'm calling from Louisville, Kentucky. To balance the budget, first thing I would do is cut off foreign aid, all of it. Second, welfare, corporate welfare and individual welfare. Cut it. After those two steps, it'd be time to reevaluate and decide what needed to be cut next.
What would you cut from the federal budget? Let us know, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or join the conversation on the Takeaways Facebook page. Actually, it's good times.
It's about 4.8%. At least that's the official unemployment rate. And that is very, very good relative to the unemployment rates we have seen over the last 8 years.
But our new president wants to find jobs, 25 million of them.
My administration's policies and regulatory reform, tax reform, trade policies will return significant manufacturing jobs to our country. Everything's going to be based on bringing our jobs back, the good jobs, the real jobs.
And former Labor Secretary Robert Reich says there is a crazy numbers game trying to figure out the real unemployment rate in this economy. You can hear it in this exchange between Sean Spicer and a reporter at a briefing last month. What is the overall unemployment rate?
What's the overall unemployment rate?
Are you talking about whether or not we include the full? I mean, the Bureau of Labor Statistics puts it out. It's not a question of what I accept. I mean, there are ways that you can put out full employment.
I know the difference.
Right, but I'm saying that so there's a reason that we put out several versions of that.
Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick spoke to Robert Reich, who is anxious to know if the Trump administration is serious about going places to find jobs other administrations have feared to tread.
To be charitable to Sean Spicer, he's right. There is a lot of unemployment in terms of people who are not even in the labor force looking for work. The labor force, it's called the participation rate. It stands today at about 62.9%. That is, 62.9% of the eligible workforce is in work, and that's pretty low. So a lot of people have, for one reason or another, opted out of even looking for work. It may be because they don't have the skills, and they are so far away from having the skills that they don't even bother. Or it may be that geographically they're very far away from where the jobs are and they can't really move very easily. And that certainly is a trap that some Americans find themselves in. Some of that has to do with people who are moving toward retirement. And the baby boomers, a very, very large group, obviously, they are in retirement or moving toward retirement very quickly. And some of them are reflected in that 62.9% labor participation rate. The less charitable view is that the White House would like to set the bar fairly low, or at least not nearly where it is today, in terms of showing progress over the next two or four or even conceivably 8 years. That's hard to do when you have an official unemployment rate of 4.8%. It's not going to get much lower than that.
It seems like regardless of which of these measures we take, and the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which you use to run it, has several different measures, but it seems like the point is the change over time. Regardless of how you're measuring it, compare 2016 to 2019 when you get there and see how the curve has changed when you're measuring consistently.
Exactly. And that's the true of almost all economic measures. You really only find them valuable in the context of what happened before. Are things getting better or are things getting worse?
Well, one of the things that you mentioned in there, Secretary Reich, was places, especially small towns in rural America, where the jobs may have left or people aren't living close to jobs anymore. And this employment crisis in rural places seems to be one of the key factors here that's still under-discussed in this debate about unemployment in the United States. Not that jobs aren't around, but jobs have moved, manufacturing jobs have moved or left, and that the jobs that do exist have sort of pushed out to the edges.
And that is it's a large problem. You're right, it's not discussed very much. In rural America, many areas of America that used to have a lot of what we used to call Rust Belt industries, big manufacturing. As those have declined, you find both in rural and in these kinds of urban areas a lot of structural unemployment. People can't very easily move to where the new jobs are, in part because the value of their homes, if they own their homes, has declined relative to the value of homes in regions of the country where there are a huge number of jobs and the demand is very high. And because the demand is high, home values, housing costs are much, much higher. That's kind of a deeper and larger problem in the United States because we're seeing much more concentration of economic activity and wealth, and also much more concentration in other places of economic inactivity and poverty.
President Trump benefits from a 4.8% unemployment rate and a slow recovery. But structural changes in the U.S. economy are what the president needs to worry about, according to Robert Reich, former labor secretary under Bill Clinton. Investing in temporary projects, making steel pipelines, or putting coal miners back to work are not programs that create permanent, high-paying work. In a conversation with The Takeaway's Todd Zwillick, Reich says Trump can rant about globalization and losing jobs to foreign competition all he wants, but he says workers can't compete against automation and the new robots coming online.
Technology inside American companies, located in the United States, has led to a huge and growing amount of displacement because, frankly, we just don't need all those bank tellers. We have automated teller machines, or all those service station attendants because we have automated service stations.
How about all those coal miners?
And coal miners, too. When I was Secretary of Labor 20 years ago, I went down to the bottom of coal mines several times and was amazed even then to see that coal miners are high-tech workers. They're working on very complicated machines. They don't have pickaxes. They're actually working right on the brink of usually seams of coal that require a lot of reading of dials and meters and adjustments that these high-tech workers are making. And like every other kind of work in the United States, technology is making these workers more productive and at the same time reducing the number of workers who are necessary to do the job.
In the short term, President Trump, and he's not the only Republican who cheers for fossil fuel and for pipelines, say that, look, that's jobs, that's steel. We can do U.S. steel and we can get U.S. workers on the Dakota Access Pipeline, on the Keystone XL Pipeline, that's the point. Look, we're burning oil, we're selling oil, we might as well build the pipeline and get people to work wearing hard hats. What's wrong with that?
Well, I understand the argument. The trouble is once you build the pipeline, those jobs are finished. And the actual building of a pipeline, it may be a year, two, three, 4 years, you know, there are many jobs associated with that kind of infrastructure. But then you have very few jobs in terms of maintaining the pipeline. What you need in today's economy are jobs that have a future. And these jobs, frankly, don't.
The president talks about massive infrastructure programs. Democrats want to flirt with that because they've always wanted to spend big government money on big jobs and manufacturing jobs that come along with infrastructure. But it seems to me that there's a real political imperative here, isn't there? I mean, both sides would love to tap that wellspring of middle-aged, mostly male, underemployed, angry voters and get them out there building roads and bridges. Is that really what this is about? And are people prepared to spend the kind of money, the kind of Rooseveltian FDR money that it's going to take to really get people back to work in this way?
The short answer is no. We do have a lot of what's called deferred maintenance on our roads, bridges, pipelines. I'm talking about sewers and water systems, our dikes and public transit systems. They are, in some cases, falling apart, literally falling apart. And we should be investing in them. They are the things that connect our workforce to work and to each other. And interest rates around the globe in terms of the availability of global capital are very low right now, and it would be the right time to do this. It would also create a lot of jobs. But it's hard to do it quickly. As we learned in 2008, 2009, you don't have that many shovel-ready programs that you can immediately get a lot of people into. And secondly, the way that Donald Trump and his administration have been talking about this infrastructure plan, it's going to be revenue neutral, using tax credits to lure private investors. That's probably not going to be stimulative in terms of creating a lot of additional demand for workers.
The White House website says 25 million jobs in a decade, according to the Bringing Back Jobs and Growth tab on whitehouse.gov. That's the Trump plan, or at least that's the Trump billboard before we see a plan. Does 25 million seem realistic to you?
I would say that it's on the optimistic side of realistic, that it's not completely out of the question. During Bill Clinton's administration, the United States created 22 million net new jobs, and that was over an eight-year period. And so the possibility of creating 25 million net new jobs over a 10-year period is not out of the question. It is unlikely, though, given that population growth is slowing, given that productivity growth is slowing, given that we have a lot of technological displacement. I mean, just think about the possibility of the self-driving car or truck. There are 4.5 million Americans in commercial driving jobs right now. And if that happens, you get self-driving cars and trucks. Well, those people are going to have to find other work.
So if Donald Trump called you in to help the president set policy in a way that might be politically passable for him, what would you tell the president, Mr. Secretary?
Well, I'd tell him if he called me, and let me make it very clear, I'm available. I'm available anytime, any hour. If he called me, I'd say there are two separate problems, and you have to address both. One is the number of jobs, particularly for those who are too discouraged to look for work. And that is mostly a regional problem, and you need to diversify certain regional economies and get industries in there, like new green technologies, for example. The second problem is a problem of stagnant wages. It's not just the number of jobs, it's the quality of the jobs. Most jobs today pay, if you adjust for inflation, just a little bit more than they paid in the year 2000. And so we've got a lot of underlying economic insecurity that comes from stagnant wages and also from an economy that's generating more contract jobs, jobs that don't have any necessary future attached to them because the jobs are just as long as the contract endures. So I would say, Mr. President, you've got to really take a look at job quality. You also, Mr. President, ought to be investing more and better in education, K through 12, but also community colleges and technical education. Look at Germany. They have precision manufacturing competitiveness and a lot of jobs in precision manufacturing and in high technology that don't require a college degree. So, Mr. President, I would definitely invest more in technical and community college education.
That's Todd Zwillick in conversation with Robert Reich. We heard the heartbreaking conflicts of a young Indian American woman thinking about her identity in yesterday's program after a brutal shooting in her community last week.
I go to school, I go to public school, and I'm very American in that sense. But I also come home to an Indian house, and I'm bilingual. I appreciate the culture. I don't have prejudice against anyone.
Young Jania Chakraborty's voice conveys the sense of young people from South Asia feeling the pressure of living in two worlds in today's complex America. One of the movies up for an Academy Award this week, Lion, addressed this theme directly. Actress Manita Gandhi has created a piece of powerful theater by taking audiences on her own journey to find a voice, an identity, as both an American and an Indian. In her one-woman show, Motherland, it's about a return to India to retrace her father's steps from her family home, clutching her father's old suitcase. In the course of her journey, she was sexually assaulted and escaped terrified in the India she thought would happily welcome her back. Motherland has been a way for Manita to explore gender and race assumptions in two cultures at once. It's a story told in brutal headlines such as the 2012 Delhi gang rape and murder of 23-year-old Jyoti Singh on her way home from a movie. Manita says her life echoes the horror of the Singh case portrayed in India's Daughter, a PBS documentary.
I decided to file a complaint, and I was put in a room with 10 men in a room at a temple, including the doctor, the man who had assaulted me, and nobody in that room believed me. And when he finally admitted what he did, he just said, fine, everything she said is true, and there was no sense of remorse. And I remember that hitting me in the gut because they just wanted me to get out of there.
Can you describe the epiphany you had yourself when you really decided that you weren't going to allow the Indian government or anyone to suppress the discussion of sexual violence?
Sure. So I just started writing my play, and I was in the first table read, and I hadn't obviously known about the assault that had happened in India in 2012, and I knew that this documentary was coming out. And the week of the table read of my play, the Indian government banned India's Daughter from being shown in India because they thought it would defame India. And we were sitting around the table reading my play, which at that time was just a series of stories about my trip to India in 2009, and I was skimming over the assault. And I just had such a visceral reaction to the Indian government banning that documentary that even though I had healed from my own experience, I realized that there was some part of me that felt like I shouldn't talk about being a survivor of an assault, that it would bring some level of shame upon my family or myself. And I didn't understand why that existed in myself. And I realized at that point, if it was something that I expected the world and society to give voice to and to not give shame to, that I needed to do that for myself. And so that's when I decided to do some rewrites, and I wrote about the assault in detail. And I think it's actually been a very important part of my play. I don't feel that my play is about the assault. I think it's a plot point in the play, just the same way I think it's a plot point for many people who go through something like that in their life. You're going on with your life, you're trying to figure out all of these other things, and then all of a sudden something like that happens. And I think what it did for me is it taught me how I can have a voice. It gave me my voice in a strange way.
You talk about being comfortable in your own skin, yet on stage, you are beyond naked, it seems to me, at certain points. How does that feel?
I've never been more terrified in my life as an artist than doing this show. And I always think that means I'm doing something right. But it is. It's scary because I'm sharing my life and my family's life and the decisions I've made in my life, for better or for worse. And particularly the time of the assault, my body gets really tense right before I get into that scene. And the reason that I think I'm able to do it is because I've survived it. And I know from doing the play now, it's helping so many people. And so knowing that you're using your art as activism can push you through it, and it lets you be naked because it allows other people to be naked too.
Can you share with us what happened in the assault? I mean, the play does that, and your art mm-hmm. does that, but I think we Absolutely. Need to know a few details.
Sure. So I had gone to India in 2009 for my brother Milan's wedding. He was getting an arranged marriage. I was having a beautiful time. I felt very spiritually open. I was in a place with not a lot of electricity. I would wake up at 4 or 5 in the morning, go to yoga, do a lot of Ayurvedic treatments, pray and meditate. And there was a doctor who was running the facility with his wife, who was the other doctor there. And on my fourth night there, which was a Saturday night, and I think it's important to note that Sunday morning was a day off, so a lot of people were gone from the facility. He came to my room at around 10 or 11 at night and knocked on my door, and I opened the door even though I had a gut feeling that told me not to. And I had some knee injuries and back injuries from a show I had done that I was working on healing. And in the morning, he generally checked on me with his assistant, but he just kept asking me, you know, how's your back and knees? How are your back and knees? Let me check on them. And I kept saying no. And then I just felt like I was being rude. And I know that sounds ridiculous, because every time I tell this story, I say, wow, I let him in because I felt rude. And that is the biggest thing that has bothered me. So I let him into my room and I lay down on the bed, and then he locked the door to the room. And it wasn't until he was on top of me that I could really smell the alcohol. So he was drunk and I was terrified, and I knew in my mind that my passport and my keys and my phone were locked in a safe like you do when you're in India, and that he was much bigger than me, and there was a steel door that he had locked the room with, and that there was no way for me to physically get out from underneath him. And so, you know, he started taking off my clothes. I tried to resist as much as I could. And while all of this was happening, my mind was just going very fast. How can I get out of this? How can I assess things? And I put it in the play, and I'm not sure if it reads the way that it was in the moment, but there was a copy of Eat, Pray, Love that I had brought with me to India. And I kept staring at the binding of that book because it was the thing that I could see from the bed where I was at. And I just remember thinking, that's going to be the last thing I see. I'm going to die here. And finally, when I was naked, I'm trying not to be too graphic, but his hands had been inside me, and he knew that I was on my period because he's my doctor and I had seen him that morning. The way that I got out of it was I told him that my flow was heavy and I needed to use the bathroom. And he said, that's okay. It doesn't bother me. And I said, no, my flow is heavy. And I tried to play coy, and he got off from me. He got, you know,
Manita, you don't have to make excuses. This tactic, this trying to save yourself.
I guess I just,
so degrading.
I'm sorry. I sometimes think I don't get emotional about it because I've talked about it so much. But, you know, I got him off for me, and then he grabbed my nightgown, and I said I was cold, and he wouldn't give me my nightgown back. And then I smiled at him, and I got my nightgown back, and I walked to the bathroom, and it was a really eerie walk. I walked towards the bathroom really slowly, and I was naked, and I was bleeding, and he was just watching me, and I got to the bathroom, and then when I got to the bathroom, I locked that door to the bathroom, and there wasn't plumbing there, so I was pouring water into a bucket to sound like I was peeing while I got dressed with my other hand, trying to figure out what to do, and then I knew that I couldn't jump up on the small water bins in the bathroom and get out the window because I was in the middle of nowhere in India, and I would be in danger in a nightgown. So I thought, okay, I can either lock myself in this bathroom all night until someone comes, or I can try to get him out of my room. So once I was dressed, there's a line in my play where I say my nightgown feels like steel armor, because that's what it felt like, this thin cotton nightgown. And I put it on, and I opened the bathroom door, and I held onto the bathroom door with one hand, and I told him very slowly in English, I'm uncomfortable. You need to go. Please stop. And he looked at me in disbelief, and he was so confused. And I said it again. And finally he said, are you showing me the door? And I said, yes. And he left, and I bolted towards the door, locked it. And then I got into the safe, and I called my parents, which was an awful feeling. And my brother, who was being driven to the airport to leave India, I said, you know, please give Dad the phone. I'm in trouble. Don't tell them the details. But the doctor tried to hurt me. And this is really amazing because my father got on the phone and I was in a place where I couldn't talk very loud. The doctor understands every language that I speak. And I didn't know if he was outside the window of my room. And my dad just said, are you not safe? And I said, no. And he said, okay, I can take a sleeper train and be there in the morning. And I was quiet. And he said, you need to get out of there now. And I said, yes. And he said, I'll call the doctor. And I was quiet. And in that moment, I don't know how my dad understood. And he said, it's the doctor. And I said, yes. And he just, in a split second, said, okay, I'm going to call your cousin who you haven't met. And I'm going to say that your grandfather, who's my grandfather was already passed, but he said, I'm going to say your grandfather has passed and your cousin's going to pick you up. And I said, okay. And we got off the phone and there was a boy who I had met at the facility who was younger than I, who was there for weight loss. And we used to trick the watchman of the of the facility by throwing food at the stray dogs, and we distract the watchman. We'd run out into town, and because he was there for weight loss, he would get fruit from the fruit vendor. And because I wanted to go to the internet cafe, I'd go to the internet cafe. And he had gone drinking with the doctor that night, and he had told me that he was going to bring me a big bag of fruit. So right after I got off the phone with my dad, there was a knock on the door, and it was that boy. And I didn't know if he was in cahoots with the doctor, but I opened the door and he was just standing there with this big bag of fruit and so confused. And he helped me. This stranger helped me so much. He stayed in the room with me. The doctor called him, tried to get him out of my room. He stayed with me until my cousin came. And then I got on my cousin's scooter, and my cousin actually thought, because he was a second cousin who I'm not close to, he actually thought my grandfather had passed away. And I got to my cousin's place, and in the morning, my dad was there, and I said I wanted to file a complaint. And my father said, no way, this is India. And I have never felt this way before, but I have never been so ready to die for something in my life. I knew that I couldn't leave India without doing something about this.
There's a moment, and it's part of the play, and you're on the phone. Your father understands that you're in danger. Your father understands that you can't talk about the danger that you're in, or you might be in more danger. He senses that. He figures out what to do, and he saves you. What did that teach you about what a father knows about a daughter? And in all of the experience that's happened since, your writing of the play, you're confronting him, you're talking with him, interviewing him, what has he, in addition, learned about what it means to be a father?
You know, my dad's biggest fear is something happening to any of his children. And for some reason, it's particularly me. And in that moment, we've always had that love. But in that moment in India, where he was on the phone, he just knew. I think he has learned flexibility. I think that's the big thing, because he didn't want me to file a complaint in India. He was worried that we were going to get killed. And he knew how important it was to me, because I really fought for that, that he let that go because he knew that I needed that. You know, when I told him I wanted to write about this in the play, he said, oh, it's not the Coming to America story, because I had been interviewing him and he thought that's what it was about. And I said, no. And he said, are you going to write about what happened in Gujarat? And I said, yes. And he said, I don't think you should do that. And I sent him an article for Mother Jones about these women that were protesting the ban on the documentary. And he understood it. And I think he's just learned a lot of flexibility. And I have seen him have a lot of pride about it, that we are able to help other women.
He once said, you hated India. Was he right? And have you changed?
Yes. So I have always had a deep love for my culture and for India. And when the assault happened, I struggled. When I got home after the assault and I was finally showered and it was 48 hours later in Mumbai when I was just with my parents in a flat alone in India, I lost it. I said a lot of terrible things. I said that I hated India, that I thought that the country was dirty. I said that I never wanted to come back. And I said those things, and in the moment, I meant them. And I think it's because it comes back to that idea of pluralism, that I had assigned this doctor, this man who had violated me, to represent India. And it wasn't until I had healed that I discovered that. And truly, it wasn't until I had written the play that I discovered how there was a certain part of me that had taken that little bit of pain that I was still holding on to and assigning it to a whole culture and a whole country. And I was finally able to let go of that, because I was like those blind men. I was only looking at this tail of the elephant. I was only seeing this man who had hurt me. That's why in my play, what I really hope the audience sees, and I think they do, is there's so much beauty in India and Indian culture. And there's a lot of characters in my play that are real people in my life that are Indian or are Indian American, that are so kind and generous and have struggled with me to help me become the empowered woman that I am.
Manita Gandhi, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Manita Gandhi is an actress and playwright. She will be performing her one-woman show, Motherland, across the country. Her next stop is in Portland, Oregon, at the AGE Symposium on March 4th and 5th. For more dates, visit thetakeaway.org. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Federal policy making family life miserable for some military families. Nothing complicates the lives of two-income families with kids worse than suddenly losing child care. And at least two U.S. military bases, including Fort Knox and Marine Corps Base Camp Lejeune, have suspended their hourly daycare programs because they can't hire new staff quickly enough with the federal hiring freeze under President Trump. The full-day programs have been deemed essential and left intact.
This is definitely not a minor thing to many military families. I've heard from at least one spouse who's having a family member coming up to live with them at Fort Knox to fill the gap on this. But most military families don't have that option. Good luck finding a family member who happens to be free, right, who can come and live with you for an undetermined period of time to take care of your child.
That's Amy Bouchatz, reporter for military.com and a military spouse, who says these closures have put a significant burden on the military families that rely on the hourly services, but the strain is not unique to the Trump administration.
You know, I would say that this actually is one of these things that's true in the past administration and in this one. What I hear from military families is that they're sort of tired of being used as a pawn in a lot of these different measures and decisions. And that's true on Capitol Hill when it comes to passing budgets and hiring freezes and potential government shutdowns. And that's true coming from the White House as well. Military families are often sort of the unanticipated collateral damage of a lot of these decisions, because so much of our lives is dependent on government funding. It's just the nature of the beast. Our childcare programs, as we've been talking about, are run by what are essentially government workers. Our grocery stores are run by government workers. It's sort of a perfect storm of real life meets federal policy and legislation. And the result of that is sort of that collateral damage, as I just said, that comes when lawmakers decide to, and the White House decide to take steps that they don't necessarily anticipate will have this direct implication on real people.
And here are some numbers, and you can, you know, confirm these. There are about 230 child care centers worldwide on bases all over where the U.S. flag flies. There are 2,657 vacancies, and the programs that those vacancies are in care for 180,000 children every day.
To make those numbers seem even more shocking, I must add that that's actually just the Army. Just imagine that sort of multiplied. That's just Army kids, not Navy, not Marine Corps, not Air Force, just Army.
So far, you've been spared this, but you're a working journalist. I gather you don't have to worry about your kids right now.
I don't. My kids are in school. I personally do not rely on the child development centers, as they're known at this time, but a lot of people do.
And you can understand the fears of parents in this kind of a situation.
Absolutely. People lie on childcare, and childcare is not a small thing. It's a very stressful thing. You know, speaking as a parent myself, and what I hear from our readers, when you're trying to get childcare for your kid, that's something you labor over. That's something that you worry over. It's something, if it falls through at the last minute, it's sort of this exponential stress. And so having childcare be an iffy topic for military families who, you know, until recently could rely on these programs consistently. What I'm hearing from our military.com readers is that this is a big deal. This is very stressful. Even the implication or the suggestion that their child care center at their base may be subject to this is striking a real sense of discomfort and stress in military families' lives.
Amy Bouchatz is a reporter for military.com and also a military spouse. Amy Bouchatz, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
The I Do business is in trouble over allegations of You Will. Thousands of allegations made public about Sterling Jewelers, which operates Jared and Kay Jewelers. Statements from employee victims, only coming to light now for the first time, describe a workplace in which male-dominated management intimidated and harassed a mostly female workforce for years. The Kay Jewelers that makes billions from selling rings that get women to say, I do, behind the sales counter, these allegations say its coercive male managers are getting women employees to say, I will, by refusing advances, pressuring employees for sex. Drew Harwell is covering this story for The Washington Post.
So this came to us as part of this huge class action lawsuit that now includes about 69,000 women. The basics of the case are that they're alleging this systemic discrimination of pay and promotion practices in Sterling, where most women just say, no matter how good you did in the store, you would be paid less than your male coworkers, even if they were less experienced, even if they produced less for the company. So that's the basics of it. But through that, there has been a pattern where hundreds of these women who filed sworn statements sort of based on their experience said it wasn't just pay and promotion. It was demeaning languages from the bosses telling us to hike up our skirts in the store to get more customers. It was executives and managers sort of sending out, you know, what they called kind of hunting parties or scouting parties to stores, you know, across the network to find women that they thought were attractive and that they wanted to sleep with. And it was stuff like a saleswoman would say to her boss that her husband was getting a transfer or she wanted to go to a better store. And that boss using that information and sort of leveraging it into forcing the women or demanding the women have sex with them at some of these company events even before they allowed that to happen. And this was not just, you know, one or two instances. This was many, many women saying this happened, in that it was sort of like the worst kept secret in the company, that women knew that if you really wanted that promotion, that this was the gate you had to pass. You know, the specifics of these were really galling, and a lot of them were focused on these annual kind of managers meetings, which were no spouses allowed. They were very boozy. It was almost like multi-day long, sometimes week-long events where all the managers from across the country, many of them women, would get together, you know, at this resort. And this is where a lot of the bosses were accused of being almost predatorial and sort of seeking out these young saleswomen in this place where they felt like this was a chance where they could really sort of leverage their influence and leverage the jobs they had and getting women to do what they wanted. You had to effectively do what they wanted you to do to just keep a job. And a lot of these women were young. They were mothers. They had families. This was the job that they felt like they really needed to keep to ensure that their family had a good lifestyle. So they were just put into this horrible position. And this was something that just lasted for years. And many women are still dealing with today.
Tell me the numbers of floor sales staff versus male-dominated management.
I think 70% of their sales force are women. And so there's an army of saleswomen and, you know, a very small number of sort of male executives at the top of the pile.
So the product is romance at Sterling Jewelers, but the job description is something a little bit different.
This was the romance business. This was, you know, every kiss begins with K, a store that, you know, makes billions of dollars a year selling, you know, effectively pricey rocks and really nice jewelry to people all across the country. So they have to put forth an image. They have to offer something that's so attractive that when you're walking by it in the mall or driving by the store outside the mall, you're captivated and you have to stop in. And thankfully, you meet this really friendly saleswoman. And, you know, these are saleswomen who a lot of times wanted to work at a jewelry store. They wanted to feel a part of this process of providing romance for a man buying a gift for his wife, for two newlyweds who just got their engagement rings. So the juxtaposition was so stark for them because it was, we're in this business that depends on female clients and that is staffed by a predominantly female workforce. And yet the discrimination and harassment and demeaning relationship they saw with their male bosses was worse than a lot of them had ever seen in any workplace.
Drew Harwell, national business reporter for the Washington Post. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
He's been gone. Well, be 18 years in March.
You go from headed to medical school to heading to prison. It was almost incomprehensible.
It was hard. I wasn't here for a lot of stuff.
It is a weight lifted off your shoulders. So now he's going to be home and safe.
They granted it and they can't take it back. They can't take it away.
Still seems like a dream. Like I said, he's been turned down so many times.
It is going to be a ride.
President Obama decided to relook at your case and he granted you clemency today.
Yesterday, in part one of our series, Commuted, Life After Prison, Aaron Glasscock's family is full of emotion and anticipation. After 18 years in prison, Aaron had his sentence commuted by President Obama. Here in part two, his family is on their way to pick up Aaron. Can his family's memories of the past before prison connect to this unknown future now rushing at them? Takeaway producer Dana Roberson takes us there.
Breaking news, weather and traffic station, News Radio.
It's the day of Aaron's release, a chilly Wednesday morning, and the sun hasn't come up yet. We are in Aaron's sister's car, an SUV with room for both Aaron and the clothing and essentials that his mom, Pigeon, has been gathering for him. Pigeon and close family friend Eddie Lanham sit in the back. I sit up front with Aaron's sister, Jeannie Yoakum.
I'm Jeannie. I'm Aaron's sister. I'm actually driving everybody to get him. I'm really excited. Didn't get much sleep last night. I'm trying not to drive too fast, but my foot keeps wanting to go down faster, so I just want to get there and get him.
It's about a two-hour drive to Manchester Federal Correctional Institution, and although they have taken this ride hundreds of times before, this one feels different. There is a jittery tension in the air. The two-hour car ride is filled with some humor and then moments of reflection and hope for whatever will come next.
My name is Ed Lanham. I'm from here in Gravel Switch, Kentucky. I met Aaron and his mom and Jeannie through my aunt many years ago. They were friends. He was around 16 probably at the time. Yeah. You just knew, you know, he was headed for great things, you know. I think we're still in shock over 18 years later. We're still in shock that it even happened. And I guess the worst thing for me, and I'm sure all of you all, is that we've just felt helpless through this entire process.
It was hard. I was close to Aaron. Of course, I'm the baby. He spoiled me, and he'll tell you that too. So it's been hard, especially with him not being here and being with me on special occasions. When I graduated, he had wrote me a special letter that I carried with me in a picture. But now I'm just so glad he's going to be home.
Every time you go visit him, when you have to say goodbye, here we are walking out those doors, going back to our regular life. And he always put up the biggest front. You look back at him, you got to do that last glance, last wave goodbye. And he would always have a smile on his face, just like everything was great. And you know, he was just dying inside. So this is the one time.
No last glances, right? Oh, gosh.
No last glances.
Pigeon, who is usually very chatty, spent most of the ride quiet and reflective.
Sometimes it depended on who the guard was there, and I'd go, can I just hide him in my pocket? And can you look the other way for a minute? And I'll just put him in my pocket and take him with me. You know, little, you know, silly things like that. And sometimes, you know, they'd answer and they go, I wish you could. You don't know how many times I wished I had that little magic wand where I could shrink him down and put him in my pocket, bring him on with me. But today I won't have to worry about it.
We're a close family anyway, and we always have been. And this has probably made us even closer as a family. And going through this journey, even afterwards, I would say will make us even closer and stronger.
I saw you brought something for him.
Yes, my daughter, Emma, loves her Uncle Aaron, and we had to get her school picture and a little one and cut it out because she said Uncle Aaron had to put that in his wallet.
What are you going to do when you see him and you guys walk out?
I'm going to give him a big hug.
By the time we arrive, the sun has come out and the mood has shifted.
Hi, we don't have to look at that barbed wire fence anymore, do we?
We do not. This will be it. This will be the last time.
Only Pigeon and Jeannie head into the prison. I wasn't allowed in, but I could see the back of Aaron's head through the glass doors. Back at the car, Eddie is waiting.
Doesn't seem real.
Well, he was sitting there.
Well, good. Good. Good, good, good.
He talked about the toll that Aaron's imprisonment has put on the family.
I mean, literally, I went to see him the day he left for his trial. And I said, I'll see you in a few days. I mean, he hadn't done anything. So I'm like, there's no way they can convict him. And then they put him through four trials. They just kept trying him until they had mistrial after mistrial, and this happened and that happened. You can imagine what it's taken to pay for four trials. I mean, it's all but bankrupted them. She sold her house and moved to a different house. She's taken extra jobs. Pigeon has fought so hard. I'm hoping him being home will be a turnaround for her health even.
No more than 30 minutes had passed since Jeannie and Pigeon walked into prison. They walked out, a threesome, with Aaron.
Hey. How you doing, buddy?
Better now.
This is Dana. How are you, Dana?
I'm good. How are you? Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Congratulations.
Well, thank you.
Get the back.
Back?
Yep. You All sure? Back. You want him in the back? Or? I want him in the back for me.
Okay. Wow.
Tomorrow, we'll hear Aaron in his first hours of freedom.
I've got a list of, my one list is things that I need to do, you know, like get my license, get a phone, get a job, you know, just small things that I need to get done. And then the other list are things for me to watch out for.
And then, after just 3 hours, the family must say goodbye to Aaron again, this time at the halfway house.
Maybe this was just a little bit different plan that God had for him to help reach people that he would have never, ever reached otherwise. So that's just the way we had to look at it, you know.
That's all coming up in our series, Commuted, Life After Prison. This is Dana Roberson for The Takeaway.
The president says he wants to add $54 billion to the defense budget. Where would you find the money?
This is Greg from Chicago. If I had to make cuts of $54 billion to the budget, I would start with the DEA and with prisons. The war on drugs is a never-ending losing battle that strains both local and federal governments. It's a money pit. Getting rid of all of that would be great.
Looking for your suggestions. What would you cut? 877-8-MY-TAKE or head to the Takeaway's Facebook page. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.